Hey, this is Zach.
And I'm Clint, and we wanted to thank ExoTerra for sponsoring this episode of Colubrid and Colubroid Radio.
ExoTerra is the industry leader in glass terrarium enclosures, and we are a big fan of getting to see the species we work with both at home and at the university.
We utilize ExoTerra caging here at Metazotics, and in addition to top quality terrariums, ExoTerra offers an array of heating options, lighting, supplements, decor, and truthfully, anything needed or wanted when keeping reptiles.
Thank you, ExoTerra, for supporting Colubrid and Colubroid Radio. Welcome to yet another episode of Colubrid and Colubroid Radio. As always, Zach here with my brother from another mother, Mr. Clint Bartley. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, my man. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. The semester is over. and I've already got one herping trip in. It hasn't been done for a week yet. I did this last year. It was the smartest thing I ever did. I don't know if you remember, but like... semester ended on a Friday, graduation was a Saturday, and then we flew to Minnesota on a Sunday. This time I stayed home for Sunday, and we went out on a herping trip, and I'll talk about that, and it was extremely successful. So, nice. Yeah, that's how I'm doing. How are you, my friend?
Just hectic, as always. you know, it's wild. There's constantly so much to do, even though this particular week – it's probably been, I mean, we're recording right now on a Thursday, which is not typical for us. One of the slowest traffic weeks I've experienced in Metazotics, you know, this year. Now, we've had some storms roll through the Midwest and all that that I think kind of kept people out the past couple of days. But so it's been, you know, a slower traffic trend, but it's like, but this has been one. Still feel like, man, I can't get ahead. I can't get caught up. But, you know, then I look at, you know, I am marking things off my board. I'm getting things wiped off the list. So it's like, okay, you are making some progress.
Yeah.
You know? Both with Metazotics, we've made some progress on the CCR.
We have.
You know, things like that. So, yeah, man, all in, things are good. Things are good. Just tired. I've been walking a lot more. I've not got to do any field herping, but I, you know... I used to walk. I'm a very competitive individual at times. You know, and I when I got a Fitbit years and years ago, this is how I dropped the weight to begin with. I saw where it recommended 10,000 steps a day. So I'm like, a day? I started doing that before breakfast. And like literally, I would get 10,000 steps in before breakfast every day. And that just shed the weight. Well, I've not been real happy with myself and my energy level over the past couple months. So got back into that. So getting my 10,000 steps in before breakfast every morning. And I already feel the energy boost from it. So nice. Good stuff. Nice, good stuff for me.
Well, if I give my updates, I guess it involves multiple days with 10,000 plus steps. I think one of the days we got to 19,000 steps.
Nice.
But yeah, I mentioned our herping trip. I actually had two trips since we recorded last that were pretty successful on the herping front. Let's go to the first one. So right after we recorded with Mike, I hopped in a university van and I went to the AZA reptile tags meeting. And I was pleasantly surprised to find out that quite a few zoo professionals listened to our show. So if you're listening and you were at the tags meeting, it was wonderful meeting you, and keep listening. I actually have plans to bring some of them on the show. So we're going to get the zoo perspective of Colubrid keeping in the next couple months, which is pretty badass. But I was asked to give a talk there. And so, you know, I looked at my schedule and I was like, okay, so let me get this straight. I can leave during the most hectic time of my semester, go hang out with like a bunch of professional reptile nerds. In Norfolk, Virginia, which is an area that has Chesapeake Eastern King Snakes, and I have yet to find a freaking Eastern King Snake because every time I am in that part of the world, it's too damn hot. It's like end of July, beginning of August, and this was April. So of course I went, and the first day was snakes. That was great. Second day was lizards. And I was laying in bed. It was like 5 o'clock in the morning. I had the whole room to myself. Didn't bring students. I normally bring students everywhere, but this is the first solo meeting I've done in a long time. And I was wide ass awake. And, you know, my part of me is like, you need to get rest. And then there's this other part of me that's like, F that, go herping. So that one won. So I you know, headed out, not going to divulge where I went, but I went here before with my son this time last year on the way to the Outer Banks on our vacation. And it was just a miserable trip, but I was walking and I heard rustles. I looked, there's a racer and it was up on a log, and I was on a trail and I thought, okay, I'm going to go, what the hell, I'll try to catch the racer. And I have this habit of looking at my feet before I walk in. My advisor taught me that. And I'm not kidding you. 5 inches in front of my toes, completely parallel to me or perpendicular to me, was about a 4.5 foot Eastern King. And it looked exactly like the animals I have at home. Like it was like that big, awesome, wide Chesapeake band.
Yeah.
And it was really, really funny because I have a tendency. We try to keep the show PG-13, but we do say words that rhyme with truck. And when I saw it, I might have yelled one of those phrases, and there were families all around me. And I was like, damn it. You know, I teach the kids, like, don't draw attention to yourself. And here I am, alone, crazy guy, yelling four-letter words, giggling like an idiot. So waited for them to all run around, run away, caught them. But on the way to there, I stopped off in West Virginia because it's time to work on the Hognose book. And I went with my good friend Jared Kane, herping in the Eastern Panhandle. And he has a wonderful couple places to go. And we were, you know, we were finding stuff. We found a bunch of racers. We found the rat snake. We found worm snakes, which are cool. But we both wanted to find a hog or a corn. And corn snakes, like the Holy Grail of West Virginia herping. And a hog is right behind it. And I, of course, wanted the hog. And sure enough, right when we were getting the quit, looked up, boom. There it was, totally stretched out. And they're not common at all in West Virginia. Like, the state tracks them. So Jared and I lost our minds, and I got a ton of pictures for the book. So fast forward, and that trip I was talking about was for the Hognose Snake book, because I learned with the last book that it is important to get your own pictures. I've talked about this several times. I was at the mercy of many people getting pictures for the book. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a bunch of platy rhino stuff in the hog book, so I'm going to go find them myself. So I had this wonderful group of students, I've mentioned them before, that worked their asses off for me getting journal articles so that I can just read this summer. They got over 400 of them, so I have a lot of reading on hognose snakes. But I told them, if you do a good job, we'll do a herp trip at the end of the semester. So that's where we went, and we went up into PA. I met an internet friend that I now can say is a friend, Bob Long, wonderful guy. Got some of my original false water cobras from Bob. And so he took us around, and it was amazing. Prior to this trip, I had only seen, I think, 4 or 5 live Eastern hogs. In 3 days, we got 10. So,
wow.
Yeah. And it was perfect for the book. Couldn't have been better. I got Young of the Year. I got Juveniles. We got a melanistic. We got the Halloween phase. We got olive phase. I mean, so lots and lots and lots of pictures. But we also got all kinds of snakes. It was a 40 snake trip, and it was great because a bunch of those students, it was their first herping trip, and I had to keep telling them, like, this is not normal. Please do not think this is what happens with everything.
Right, right.
When you go out looking for snakes, because you know, because it was fun. I had veteran herpers on the trip, and they understood how special it was, what was happening, because they had been skunked a million times. But some of those kids, it's like when you take somebody fishing and you go fishing for bluegill and all you catch is bass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you got an ultralight reel. You're not expecting, 2 pound bass every cast. So, but yeah, no. So, that was wonderful. And I guess the only other update is we got things dropping eggs here finally. Today we had three clutches hit. Two Western or Plains Hogs, two Floridana King clutches. We have a really nice locality clutch of South Georgia Eastern Kings drop, which is good. So it's ramping up. But I know when it comes to eggs dropping, I have but a trickle, but you have a small river ahead of you. So,
oh man, you know, it's awesome with the amount. Now I say it's awesome now.
Yeah.
In 2 months, I may say something different because the, not just the number of gravid females we have, or like I guess let's back up. So I want to say I should have counted exactly to the exact number before walking in here. But I know that we're just over 30 clutches in the incubator.
That's
already.
Insane.
So there's, no, you know what? I think we're close to 40 now that I think about it, close to 40 in the incubator already. And we still have somewhere around 70 gravid females. Mm-hmm. And when I say gravid, I know they're gravid. Yeah. There's some that I'm like, you're probably gravid, but I'm not counting you. Mm-hmm. I'll check you again next week, you know, type of thing. And, you know, as we're looking through, like I'm thinking of what we call our North American room, and we're almost batting 1,000.
Yeah.
Meaning, yeah, like every female that is of size that is, you know, that could produce is gravid or has already laid. I mean, it's just insane. And when you walk from room to room, and I was getting nervous on my Asians, mm-hmm. because I wasn't really seeing, you know, a whole lot out of them. And it was funny because the Asians did great last year, and it was the North Americans that did not like the move at all. And, you know, we did terrible with them last year, but they all are, they're settled. They're good. And, you know, the Asians, it just seems like it's taken a little bit longer, but I'm starting to, you know, okay, you're getting the gravitag, mm-hmm. you're getting the gravitag. So I think we're seeing some nice movement in that, and lots of gray bands. We've had in a block eye lay nice. Already. I know that at least one of the black milk females is gravid. You know, so there's just a lot of really cool things happening. I think we may have one or two gravid rosy boas, or pregnant rosy boas. I'm not 100% sure. I'm still learning them mm-hmm. big time, you know. But again, super, super exciting. We're, you know, you finish the semester. My kids are just got a few more weeks left of school. So I'm, you know, excited to be able to get out and do some things with them, flip some tin, yep. mm-hmm. you know, and see what we can come up with. One of the things that I posted on the Facebook page and, you know, chatted with you about it, and I think maybe they're all lumped together now, but it appears that we have a copper belly population mm-hmm. on my property. That is so cool.
It is very cool, Clint.
That's now like six species. That's the sixth species mm-hmm. of snake that we found, you know, out there on the property we have in Pike County, Indiana. And I mean, copper bellies are something that there are small pockets yep. around that you can find some, but they're, I mean, it, I guess before they were all lumped together, those were considered endangered mm-hmm. in Indiana. So that was just really neat. And I've never seen one in person. And it was actually my wife who shot the video and yep. picture and sent it to me. And then just today she's out there and, she sends me a picture of a giant snapping turtle walking across the field. And then 20 minutes later, another giant snapping turtle walking across the field. Yeah. I told her, you know, there's a good chance it's either males that are looking or it's females that are
looking to lay,
you know, looking for a place to lay. Yeah. That's kind of what I'm thinking with this time of year. So, you know, that's fun. I'm really looking forward to being able to get some stuff done
nice.
You know, with that. We've, when I say little projects are getting done around here, I got to put together our first chameleon rack.
Nice.
And by rack, what I'm meaning is it's a nice display
yep.
rack mm-hmm. with multiple chameleon cages on the showroom floor. And, you know, I'm letting the team get in there and keep decorating more and more. And mm-hmm. We're actually now the tiger rat snakes
nice.
That you sent me,
yep.
Zach. We are I'm putting a cage together. I've installed UVB in it. I've
sweet.
Getting it all decked out. And, you know, they're going to end up being displayed as well. We've almost got that one finished as far as the decor, and then they'll be moving to it. So a lot of fun stuff, you know, yep. a lot of fun little, you know, projects. We're tweaking more and more, you know, getting in the right direction. So
nice.
Good stuff on my end too, man.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned projects. We've got plenty of projects planned for the summer. One of the projects involves our sponsors, Exoterra, and they helped us out at the university. We are obviously, this summer is all about hognose snakes with me. I've got some pesky crayfish reports that I have to write. And you know that meme? It's an old meme where there's the guy, and I think he's walking with the girl in the blue shirt, and he's turning around looking at the girl in the red shirt. And yeah. I live that meme because the red shirt is hognose snakes, the red shirt girl, and the blue shirt is like responsibility, which are these like multi-hundred-thousand-dollar funded grants that are coming to an end and have these 50 to 70 page monotonous reports, and they're all due. And that's usually what the kids' theses are that are my graduate students. But we usually have to tweak the thesis a little bit to meet the obligations of like the funding agency. And the idea of like sitting here for 10 hours a day, do it like that. But you know, but that's what this week and next week is all about, is just putting those all to bed. But one of the things we're going to be doing is we got a ton of the Exoterra front opening enclosures. I can't remember the exact size. Do you remember what size those are?
Pretty sure you have the 36 by 18 by 12.
Yes, 36 by 18 by 12. And I did a little bit of experiment. In fact, Clint can see, you guys can't, but right there is an Exoterra enclosure that I set up. And I think they're perfect for naturalistic heterodon keeping. Because they've got plenty of ventilation. And then the height on them is really cool because you can do some really neat things with heat gradients. And one of the things I learned last year when I was out in the field, and we saw it again this past week with the Easterns, is that like I have this hunch feeling, and a lot of herpers know this. I'm not pretending to be like, aha, figured something out no one knows. But there's something about hogs where they like to be hot. And you can basically put a dome over top of a sandy type substrate, and you can get one end of that enclosure where surface temperatures are pushing like 115, 120 degrees Fahrenheit. But then at the opposite end of the enclosure, it's like 75, which is perfect. You got a huge gradient. So, yeah. One of the students, we bought a bunch of those. I think we bought 15 of them. Yeah, so we got a lot of them, and we're setting up a whole room with those for our big females. And so as the females are laying their eggs, they're moving into those. But we're going to have them in a semi to full-blown naturalistic setup, and we're going to be doing some ethograms and looking at how much time the hogs spend on the surface versus underneath versus basking versus cool end versus warm end, and just get some fun data that I can then put in the book for people to kind of see how they're actually use a naturalistic setup. And then I got to do this quickly because this is also my talk at IHS. So I have students literally coming in on Monday, and we've had all that stuff we got from you a couple months ago. It's been sitting idly. By the end of the day, Monday, I don't care if it's an 8 hour, 10 hour, 12 hour, 20 hour day, it will all be set up. And you know, it's going to be pretty wicked, but I thought it'd be fun to show the progress of that on our Facebook page. So we're going to document all of that. So you guys that are hearing this now, expect, you know, check out the Facebook page. You'll see where things are on that. So good, absolutely, good stuff.
And thanks again, Exoterra, for helping us out on that. And
thank you.
Please, guys, if you're not following Exoterra already on their socials, they're on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, YouTube. You can follow them at Exoterra USA. Please do. Please do, because they certainly help us out.
Please do. And I can honestly say they were a lifesaver for us, because we wanted to do this, but then we looked at, you know, it was a little cost prohibitive, but then it wasn't. So that was pretty awesome.
Made it happen. They certainly did.
Yeah. No. So, yeah, so, that's you know, our updates.
Well, talking about projects, there's a CCR project that, you know, is pretty cool, and we should shout out. So, you know, Zach and I, we've recorded the first two what we call CCR shorts.
Yes.
And these were two, I think they came out at 45 minutes.
Yeah. We said 20 minutes.
Yeah. But we talk.
Yes. Yeah, so, it's what we do.
That's right. So these two CCR shorts, basically, these are going to be what we will launch on our Patreon soon. We're going to have a few more of these banked prior to establishing that and rolling it out. But I think, you know, the first two were fun.
Yeah,
I
think
we had a good time with it. Yeah. You know, it's to be able to deep dive into a small topic and take it as long as we want without feeling that we have to do a full like 2 hour kind of episode where, you know, I thought it was fun. I thought it was neat.
And
I think the audience is going to like it too. I really hope so.
Yeah.
So look, for more information about CCR shorts and Patreon, hopefully in the next, I'd say maybe 4 weeks at most.
Yeah. So that's that. I guess we need to discuss Colubrid Fest.
We always do, don't we?
Yes.
Okay, guys. Fest. And I'm always the one who gets the honor.
Yes, you do.
All right, guys. So it's not good news. The second venue has come back and said no for the same reason that the first venue did. And that is no reptiles. And, you know, through some discussions, it's where the current hang up is with getting the kind of venue we want. We don't want the fairgrounds kind of thing, you know, and it's not knocking, you know, because most of the reptile shows that I've been at are at state fairgrounds or they're at 4-H centers, things like that. And they are perfect for reptile shows. But what we're doing isn't just a reptile show. You know, we're doing something bigger, something nicer. You know, I hate to use that word because I don't mean to put down just the reptile show. But obviously, you know, we're doing a symposium, right? You know, there's a certain – and we're really, really trying to do this all under one roof, if at all possible. So that's the hang up right now is getting – and by doing it all under one roof, you're looking at like a hotel. You're looking like a hotel convention center to be able to pull this off with the size that we're after. So that's where we're at. We're moving on to the third. And I think that we're going to probably get together and have the three of us chat a little more and see, you know, where we're at with everything, what ideas we can generate. So I promise you guys, things are still in the works. and whenever we can give the details, we will give the details.
Yeah.
So don't hate me. Don't hate the messenger. Okay.
But
Zach refuses to give these updates because he doesn't want to be the bad guy on the podcast. So.
No. But where there's a will, there's a way, and we have a very strong will.
Yes.
So this is just a war of attrition, I think, with the chosen locality. We'll just call it that. But we're gonna figure something out. That's just all there is to it. And then a couple people have reached out for talks and topics. That's what happens when you put those two words together. Please keep doing that. You know, it's going to be great when we can finally announce our proposed place. But then I have to run around like a chicken with my head cut off, much like I did for IHS, gathering up presentations and speakers and people to, you know, sit on panels and all that kind of jazz. And it's one thing to do that. For like IHS, it's all of herpetoculture. Colubrid Fest, it's just colubrids. So please, for the love of God, give me names and suggestions and topics. Because the topics and suggestions I got, like I mentioned in one of our most recent episodes, were utterly fantastic. They were way outside outside the box I was thinking. So please do that. Okay. Want to do market update? Okay. I can start with science. So the paper I want to talk about is a pretty cool one. And I really hope I didn't talk about this one already. I don't think I did. So if I did, tell me. But did I talk about
why don't you start with
self-recognition in garter snakes?
I started last week.
Okay. Yeah. I there's this whole series of papers journal articles that have been published by Morgan Skinner, and She's put out at least three, and I think I've featured at least three. So. Like, I think I featured all of them because the work to me is so relevant to keeping these animals in human care that it just needs to be discussed. So this one is actually by Morgan Skinner is what we call the anchor author, so the last author, but it's by Freeberger, and it's really simple title: Olfactory Self-Recognition in Two Species of Snakes. And so to kind of give you some context, in zoology, there's this big debate when it comes to cognition and how and what constitutes intelligence, what constitutes self-recognition, what kind of animals are self-aware, what animals are not self-aware, what drives that evolutionarily. There's a whole bunch of really kind of core fundamental animal behavior that's based around this topic. And the general consensus is the vast majority of animals that we consider to be sentient and intelligent and have high cognitive ability are absolutely self-aware. And so what we mean by this is the classic test is you put a mirror up in front of these animals. And when they look at the image, in the mirror, they don't react like it's another whatever. They kind of look at the mirror, realize they're looking at themselves, and then they kind of, touch their face, touch their nose, and they realize that, that they are seeing themselves in the mirror. And that takes a lot of cognitive ability. And apes do that. A couple other species of mammals do that. Well, the idea obviously has been that, reptiles are these kind of androids with scales. They don't have high cognitive ability. There's no way that they are self-aware. Well, recently, zoologists have figured out ways to test for self-awareness with animals that are not necessarily visually centered, as in their sense of sight is not their primary sense of interpreting the world, but rather they use chemoreception, which is a fancy way of saying smell and taste together. And if we all know snakes, chemoreception is absolutely without question the primary mechanism in which these animals interpret the world around them. And so the idea would be that they may react differently if they smell themselves than if they smell what we call a conspecific, which is another individual. And so for this study, they took a bunch of ball pythons and they took a bunch of Eastern garter snakes, and they chose these two species because of their hunting abilities or hunting strategies in their ecology. Garter snakes are active predators, so they're kind of out perusing the landscape, using a lot of chemosensing to find earthworms and salamanders and fish and things like that. Ball pythons are your classic sit and wait ambush predator, though there is some evidence recently that they are more active than that. But for the most part, they're known to kind of sit there, wait for bird or mammal to come by. They have a slower metabolism, so they can afford to do that. Garters have a faster metabolism. They have to go out and find their prey. So for this test, I'm going to reduce this down because we don't have tons of time. All that they did is they simply took some swabs of the snakes and a little bit of water, and they would dab either the area around them or the snake themselves with either another individual snake, so not them, or they would dab themselves. In other words, they would take a swab of that individual and then tap that individual again with it. And the idea here is if they're self-aware, they'll smell themselves, not really react. If they smell another individual, they'll know this is someone different than me. I'm going to like really kind of hone in and try to figure out what they are and where they are and all that kind of jazz. And lo and behold, poor ball pythons. We are not ripping on ball pythons today, but they are not self-aware. So that means that their cognitive ability is probably lesser, not as acute as the garters. And the garters, when they did this, were very self-aware. They knew and reacted the way you would expect them to react to the smell of themselves very differently than the way they reacted to the smell of other individuals. They were far more interested in other individuals than they were in, the smell that the swabs that came from them. So why talk about this on CCR? Because we keep garter snakes. We're going to have a garter snake breeder on very soon, by the way. You've asked for that. We had one reach out to us, and he's a good one, so he'll be coming on shortly. But this just kind of shows one more time that these animals are not just brainless androids, that they have the ability to recognize this is me. If they can recognize this is me, then they can recognize this is my space. they can then recognize this is her space, his space. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And then if they can recognize that and they can recognize themselves, that shows a complexity of behavior where there's this whole idea that garter snakes have friends, you know, something like, well, if they understand who they are, they can then understand who that this is not me. That then probably means that they're able to chemosense and learn a little bit more than your average snake. And the garter snake peeps that listen to our show are like, yup. you know what I mean? So there you go.
I will tell you, as far as a species, I'm not surprised to hear this about garters. I mean, in my opinion, they seem to be one of the more intelligent snake species out there that isn't as predacious. You know what I mean? Like, you get certain snake eating snakes that seem to have a higher intelligence, things like that. But, you know, garters, always, they're very alert.
Aware.
And I don't mean like skittish alert, just attentive alert. Aware. Perfect. Perfect. Aware. So yeah, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, then I'm just thinking about them, you know, the whole smell and is it me? Is it not me? And there's times I've seen like Brooks Kings where I've put them on a piece of cork bark to take a picture, and there had been another snake on that piece of cork bark. And every time the Brooks moved, it would look at itself because it could smell another snake and it would see itself move. And just, I'm like, you idiot. I've seen that happen. I've seen it happen with Honda and Milk Snake. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think so. No. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, we have a lot of king snakes here, and we have one. His name is King Charles. The students named him that, I believe. I was with my friend when he bought that at the All Ohio Reptile Show in Columbus in 1999, and it was 4 feet then. So this snake is ancient. And people have said that king snakes did this, but starting about 5 years ago, we call them his senior moments, not to be ageist, but wait. Where he will slither and find his tail and then like slowly stalk it, bite it. We have literally had to make the snake regurgitate the last third of its body like 4 times. Like, we find it as a hoop. I oftentimes wonder, like, could this have been the origin of the hoop snake? Like, because it literally is a circle. Like, it doesn't make any damn sense. I wouldn't believe it if I didn't see it. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, are like the kings as smart as the garters? I don't know. I don't know if you're self-aware if you're eating your ass. Anyway. Gosh. But so that's our science update.
Fantastic. I'll jump into the market update. As always, the market update is brought to you by the Show Me Reptile Show. They do have a few shows coming up pretty soon. Let's see. May 19th. They have shows in Janesville, Wisconsin, and St. Louis, Missouri. May 25th, Gadsden, Alabama. June 1st, Springfield, Missouri. Grovetown, Georgia, and Knoxville, Tennessee. And Loveland, Colorado, all on June 1st. And June 8th, you got Jackson, Mississippi. So if you are in those areas, please check out your local Show Me show. All right, so let's jump over into some numbers. So... it's been interesting. We continue to see that movement, but it's a big jump. Okay. So as of May 9th, ball pythons, they are now down below 36,000. They're at 35,753. That is a 3.2% change from our last recording. We've got all other pythons are only down 0.2%. They only moved five snakes fewer than a few weeks ago. So a very, very small movement there. Boas actually increased. We saw 29 animal increase, so 0.6%. That's not something we've seen too often. My assumption is, sounds like we've got a few litters that have began to hit and to become available and ready. And then, as always, the colubrids. So we saw... 214 less than just a couple weeks ago. That's a 4.3% change. So once again, for several weeks in a row here, colubrids lead the way as far as market change. Overall market, 2.8% less So that's, let's see, 1,358 fewer snakes listed on Morph Market than there was just 2 weeks ago. And before I move into just a couple of the graphs here to discuss those, I was curious because we've continued to see this trend. And again, we're going to continue mapping this out to see what it looks like year over year. But I wanted to see what was the difference from January to now as far as these categories and how does that look? And for ball pythons, there are now 9,365 fewer ball pythons listed than there were. Yeah, I mean, big, big drop, you know, than what there was in January. And then we've got, sorry, clicked off the wrong thing here. Then for other pythons, 477 less, so a 19% drop. And forgive me, that was a 21% drop in ball pythons. Boas, a 17% drop, 978. And colubrids. A 24% drop from January to now. So 1,484 animals moved in the colubrid category. So a 21% drop all the way across with 12,304 snakes fewer on Morph Market right now than what there was when we started tracking this in January. I thought that was pretty interesting. The breakdown for colubrids, we've got... corn snakes, total colubrids are 4,767. Corn snakes make up 22.2% of that. At 1301, there is one less corn snake on Morph Market this week than there was two weeks
ago.
There
you go.
The big mover, big mover, hognose. So hognose are making up 28% of the overall colubrids listed. Damn. At 1644, but that is 142 less than there were two weeks ago. 142 less hognose listed.
Good golly.
So I think there was that's an 8% drop. So a few hognose out the door.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And then for all other colubrids, they make up 30.9%, and there are 71 fewer listed this week than there were a few weeks ago. That's a 3.8% drop. So the big takeaways, again, we continue the trend. We're seeing the boas take a little bit of a lift there. Again, that could be that some litter started to drop or some imports started to make their way, you know, on. Hognose, just a major. It's funny because those rivaled 2 weeks ago. Corn snakes took an 8% drop in movement, and now hognose took an 8%. So. I think a lot of hognose found new homes.
I can get behind that.
In the overall breakdown, just a small little shifts here. Ball pythons do make up 76% of the snakes that are listed on Morph Market. Colubrids and boas are now tied at 10% each. With boas coming down just a little bit, colubrids stepping up just a little bit. I kind of like that. All other pythons are making up 4% of all the animals listed. Again, if my predictions ring true, I think we're probably going to see about maybe another 4 to 6 weeks of numbers similar to this, maybe the same trend, and then explosion, where we're going to see a big uptick. Yeah. You know, not far after that, as far as babies being listed and babies being for sale. So, I think that's it. I think that's what we got for the market update.
All right. Okay. Well, we have done all our maintenance. Time to jump on in. So our episode tonight is for all the milkheads out there. We are going to do a deep dive into milk snakes with David Deem of Temporalis Enterprises. So, David, welcome to Colubrid and Colubroid Radio. How you doing, man?
Pretty good. Pretty good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing good.
We're great. Absolutely. We're talking snakes. Yeah. So, obviously, you know, we talked a little bit beforehand. I reached out to you, I think it was over a year ago, to come onto the show, maybe a year ago. It was around this time last year, I guess. Yeah. And then it was funny. You were on the list, and Clint and I were literally saying, okay, we've done some obscure species past three. We need to get back to our kind of bread and butter species for those listeners. And then you reached out, and I was like, oh my God, it's like meant to be. So thanks for doing that. Because Lampropeltis obviously is one of the mainstay core colubrids, iconic colubrid groups that herpetoculture obviously has done quite a bit with. So before we jump into milk snakes, which we obviously are going to do, we would like to hear the backstory of David Deem and Temporalis Enterprise, which is your herpetocultural effort. So how the hell did you get into this? And is it something that happened late in life, early in life? It's always been there, got there when you were, you know, teenager. What's the story on how David got into this?
Right. So I have a story similar to a lot of people out there. Started keeping snakes when I was about 8 years old. So I'm 30 now. So the last 22 years of my life, I've always had snakes, always been surrounded by snakes. Got into the professional side in high school. I actually worked for Outback Reptiles, which is here in the DC metro area, and got to work with Ian and Ryan and the crew there and Mike Schultz, and learned about the ins and outs of exporting, importing, breeding, I was doing trade shows every weekend, my junior and senior year of high school. At that time I was actually breeding African fat-tailed geckos. When I was living with my dad at the time, and he still isn't a big snake guy. So, working for Outback that does a lot of West African imports, I really got into the fat-tailed geckos. And then in 2016, I moved to Tucson, Arizona. In 2012, I moved to Tucson and opened a pet store with a friend of mine and got really into herping. The pet store that we opened, which is still open today over in Tucson, it was Ever Evolving Exotics. And the focus of that was very focused on like naturalistic enclosures, dart frog paludariums, things like that. But we had, you know, the common stuff as well. And in 2016, I said, you know, like, I'm really into herping, really into the wildlife side of it, and I need a change. So I moved back to the DC metro area, and to go to school, and, had a small collection then, but I was really focused on herping. I mean, every spare second from about 2013 to about 2000, well, until now, any extra time I get, I'm hurt. I mean, if you remember, Zach, last year when you hit me up, I was like, I would love to do this, but I was herping, you know, 2, 3, 4 days a week. You know, that's when I burn a lot of my leave and stuff like that. And so I had a small collection from like 2016 to 2020. And most of the stuff I had was like the obscure stuff or Asian rats. You know, I really like herald snakes and different Boiga species. Oh, cool. I've had indigos and crebos, things like that. But then in 2020, I got really into looking for Eastern milk snakes, scarlet king snakes, coastal plains milk snakes here in the mid-Atlantic, and said, you know, I'm seeing all these snakes in the wild and they're so variable, and, you know, obviously don't want to take things out of the wild, but maybe I can breed them on the side, you know, from captive lines and see what I can produce. And from there, it just kind of took off. And, you know, I got really into the South American milk snakes and some of the Western subspecies. I have a lot of red milk snakes, pale milk snakes, and then all the stuff south of the border. So I mean, yeah, it's been a wild ride. I've kept in bred milk snakes before, but more of your plain Jane, Honduran or Hobby Duran, as people say, Nelsons, Sinaloans, Pueblans. But now I'm working with all of the ones that are available in captivity. from, you know, your more common stuff, like I said, Pueblans, Hondurans, all the way to like, you know, Atlantic Central Americans, South American milks, you name it, I got it.
Yeah. I think you, did you say all 23 subspecies that are available in herpetoculture you currently have in your collection?
Yes, the 23 species all available in herpeculture I have. Especially when you have
that many subspecies that
thank you.
Like, you know, there's people, for example, I'll say, hey, I've got all four subspecies of you know, Porphyracea in my collection, but that's four, right? You know what I mean? It's four. So when you can say that about 23, that's wow. What took you in that direction? You know, it's what took you to colubrids, but then specifically direction, this is what I'm going to keep right here, these.
I've always been a colubrid guy. Always. The first snakes I bred were corn snakes. As a kid, my first snake was a garter snake that I caught in my neighbor's pool. You know, like, I've always been a colubrid guy. What really got me onto milk snakes was in 2020, when the pandemic was raging, I would go out every day. I would rent a car, because you could rent a car for like $10 a day. I would rent a car to keep miles off mine, and I would just go look for milks. And because I had a very good friend of mine that was really into finding them in the wild, so I was going out with him and looking for them. And we started, because I mean, I didn't see my first wild scarlet king snake or coastal plains milk snake until 2020. I guess I'd seen coastals in New Jersey in the areas that they're much more abundant, but like in the areas that we were looking, I hadn't seen one yet. And we found one, and then we started seeing more of them, and the variation within a 100-yard circle of the snakes we were finding was insane. And I said, you know, it would be really cool to start breeding some milk snakes, and just see what comes out, because, you know, I've bred corns and kings and all that in the past, and breeding milk snakes, it doesn't matter if it's a red milk snake, a South American milk snake, a, you know, Connens milk snake, the variation in how the bands produce and how many bands they have and all of that, you never really know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
So it's kind, to me, it was kind of like, oh my gosh, like, I can breed these things, and the babies, although, you know, they're all the same species, are incredibly variable. And I feel like within, I don't know, is it, should we call it like mainstream colubrids, the like kings, corns, rats,
iconic colubrids,
the iconic, there you go. Iconic colubrids. There's nothing quite as variable without the influence of genetic mutations as milk snakes, especially when you start diving into the localities, which is my specialty.
Very, very cool.
Yeah. You know, and we said on a previous episode that there's so many of these milk snake species that we don't fully understand why they're not more popular. And maybe that's something that we can dive into on this episode.
Absolutely.
Because whenever you talk about, you know, like Lampropeltis, it's when you line up king snakes, and if you line up, you know, 10 king snake species and 10 milk snake species, and just put them on a table and ask someone that doesn't know anything about snakes, everyone's
going to pick the milk snakes.
Yeah, they typically, you know, really have that look, and they stand out, and they're the ones that they're in every children's book describing a coral snake and a milk snake. You know what I mean? And it's,
you know,
so you wonder why they don't
say that. I heard you say, I was catching up on the show three or four nights ago, and I heard you say that while I was working in my snake room, and I was like, I never thought of it like that. Like of the Lampropeltis species, it really is like the milk snakes are like, I don't know. I think of them as separate kind of, but if you combine them under that, you know, that genus, you're right. Like they are the most attractive generally, and like the ones people would pick, but there is some stigma around them, which, you know, we can certainly get into why that might be.
You know, I even think, you know, this is going back and showing the gray in the beard here, but I remember an article in Reptiles magazine. It may have been 20 years ago at this point, if not more, and it was the like the pinnacle of colubrid, you know, herping was the Arizona mountain king snake. Yep. Like if you could go out and find an Arizona mountain king snake, that's the pinnacle. And I'm thinking, think about how popular that animal, how just coveted that animal was. Yeah. And out of all king snakes, it's the one that looks the most like a milk snake. You know what I mean? Yeah. You got the color of the banding. So it's, I just think it's funny that it's, are they not more popular? So
that's funny.
Good stuff.
So, one of the cool things that I like, we have a very similar background, David, where you're doing the herpetoculture, but you're also herping.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to just talk a little bit about, what role does herping play as far as you with your herpetocultural practice? So a lot of us, I know herpers that don't own snakes. In the world that I dwell in academia, there's way more people that are, I go herping, I don't keep them, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the herpetoculture side, and I know there's quite a few people that like to keep the snakes. They might go out and look for snakes maybe once or twice, but there's not like this drive to get out there and find them and see them and maybe even gather a little bit of data on them. But what I liked about your story, your backstory, was that you didn't really get into the milk snakes until you were finding them. And then that drove you to think, could I keep these things? Blah, blah, blah. But now that you've kind of are 4 years in, what role does the herping play now as far as herpetoculture is concerned?
I have always said I am a herper first and a keeper second. And I, there are people out there that, you're right, that they either keep snakes and they don't really go snake hunting. And there's people that go snake hunting and they don't keep snakes. And my view is the best minds that I have met within reptiles in general are the people that do both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And herping for me has always been like something I can do. Whether it's by myself, just as time to like relax, whether it's with my wife and it's time we get to spend together, or whether it's with a bunch of friends and it's kind of a social thing, going out and seeing the snakes in the wild and Lampropeltis are always my target when I go out, but seeing the snakes in the wild really, number one, it gives you an appreciation for them. And number two, now that I've really dove headfirst into the milk snake keeping side of things, it helps me when I go out and I see a snake to gather data on what it's doing and what the time of year is, where it was, what the temperature was, what the pressure was. Like I have basically like a data sheet or notebook that I go through and I write all that stuff down of, as much as I can about, where it was found, what it was under, what it was doing. And then especially, because a lot of these Lampropeltis, and we'll get into it more in like the husbandry part of our conversation, a lot of these snakes I recapture over and over and over again. And watching them go from in April with a few blisters on them, hiding, under a tire, on a farm that I got permission to snake hunt on, to then in November seeing them, where they've visibly grown, but now they're using a tin stack up against the side of a building. Like watching those animals throughout the year and seeing them time and time again has really driven me to kind of make that my focus of like working specific areas and specific sites and seeing the same animals over and over again to kind of get a gauge as to what they're doing. And that helps me when it comes to like, all right, well, why isn't this snake eating? Thinking back, like, okay, is it something environmental? Is it something else?
That's really
cool. Is this the right time to be introducing animals? Things like that. So the herping side of it really for me is, besides just the like, ability to get away from my day job, to get away from the collection and just kind of do something that I have no commitment to. Like I can go out, I take my pictures and I leave. But also I can go out and see the animals and take some of that information and then use it to make my husbandry better, which is what I strive to do. And, you know, like, I'm very big on like using a very specific method, very, very like painstakingly until I can figure out something better. So it helps me from that aspect. And also, I mean, who doesn't love going out and flipping tin and boards and things like that, you know?
It's because you never know what you, I mean, you have an idea what you might find.
Right.
But I mean, when you actually flip it and find something under there, it's like opening a present, it's exciting every single time. I think, one of the things that you just said that is, it kind of popped something in my head here where what you learn by watching their behaviors in the wild and how it helps you with these animals in captivity. And really it's some of the little things you pick up on. So as I've mentioned before, around here, for me, the pinnacle species is the Eastern black king snake, you know, love finding them. And, I've kept them throughout the years, ever since I was a kid. And it's funny because it's, and this isn't going to be some big secret, but like adult Eastern black kings, if you take a wild caught adult, you're probably not going to have any problem getting it to take a mouse. They eat, mice pretty easily. A baby, different story. And, we know a lot of king snakes, you have to scent, right? But I'll tell you something that I've picked up just from going out and looking for Eastern black kings in my area. I have never found an Eastern black king snake in an area that I did not find broadhead or five line skinks first.
Yeah.
They're always a population of them nearby if there's Eastern black king snakes in that area. And I just say that because like when you mentioned the things you learn from finding these same animals over and over and over, it's for me for that one target species, figuring out, if there's, if there's this population of skinks, there's probably Eastern black kings somewhere around here too. So I think that was an excellent point you made there.
In our area here, once you start to branch out into the Midwest, out kind of where you are, where species are begins fragmenting out here. Like, I mean, there are skinks everywhere. The big thing that, I look for is the soil composition, the plant community, and then specifically the weather conditions in which they are present. I mean, and I don't want to get too much into like the husbandry thing now, but out here, if it's much above 80 degrees, unless you're talking total cloud cover and it's not like really early in the season, like they're underground, they're subterranean, they go down. And so that's helped me figure out like, okay, these snakes are cruising the front of the tub. And then I temp gun in there and it's 82 degrees and I turn it down to, 79, and then they're much more comfortable. I think that a big part of like being a good reptile keeper and steward of the animals that we have under our care is learning as much as you can about them. And Facebook and Google can only give you so much. Like you have to go out and see the animals in the wild. I mean, when I worked at Outback, Ian told me, when the ball python boom was happening and he was just getting into them, he flew to Africa and learned like what they were doing, where they were living. And, until the last day I worked there, Ian would say like, when I, in the wild, they do this, so I provide them with this. And I think that is what really separates like the kind of herpetoculturist that's, they're doing their thing and they're going along, and the exceptional ones that really like fully understand that those animals. And I think to do that, you have to just observe what they're doing in the wild time and time again.
I agree. 1,000,000%.
And then tying it even to, the keeping, because, to your point, you said you saw them cruising the front of the tub. And so you made the adjustment. So it's, you see what they do in the wild and then watching the behaviors that they give you right there, you know, in your own home. You know, it's funny because I just had a message on my day off yesterday about a hog nose, and they rattle off, you know, it was one of my, it was my wife actually. And she says, got a customer here. Hog nose is giving her some problems. You know, not eating. She says it's always on its cold side, always on its cold side. Won't venture to the hot side ever. Doesn't ever go over there. And she, you know, and they tell me the temperatures and, you know, and it's like, well, listen, yes, those temperatures are the range that if you look it up online, you're right where you're supposed to be. But sometimes you can't go off what Google's telling you. You have to go off what the animal is telling you.
Yep.
And that animal is telling you it's too hot over there because it's otherwise it would be going back and forth, be cruising. So drop that temperature down a little bit and try to feed it, you know, give it a few days. So, yeah, I mean, you know, that's bridging, you know, that's what we do here, right? We bridge the gap and that's it. It's bridging the gap between keeping them, you know, in enclosures and seeing what they do whenever they're not in enclosures. So,
yep. And, you know, the other side of it that I'll say is part of also being a, you know, what I would consider like an ethical herper or a herper that's out there looking for the animals for the sake of the animals is contributions to your state DNR agency as well. You know, when you find stuff that's like, I think in Virginia, they call it like species of greatest concern or greatest concern.
Species of greatest conservation need.
Yes. Greatest conservation need. That's correct. So, you know, going and sending them those locations and saying, hey, you know, I found this here. I just want to give them. And a lot of those state herpetologists, they love that stuff because that really helps them to, you know, enact more protections on those animals if they need it. And so I do like to do that as well. When I was in Arizona and here in Virginia, I've done that and tried to like make sure that you are sharing that information so that those animals, especially on the East Coast where development is a lot more of a problem, those animals are getting the protections that they need so that someday down the road, the next generation of herpers can go see them in the wild and not behind the glass at a zoo or even worse, you know, pages in a book.
Yeah, we do that all the time. In fact, the hognose I was talking about that we found in West Virginia, I took coordinates. I did exactly what I do when I'm out doing a crayfish survey, just flip the species.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I'm on the phone bi-weekly, it feels like, with the state herpetologist because we're working together on some stuff. But there's someone that's one of my friend. He's a friend of mine on Facebook, doesn't know that I know Kevin Oxenrider. And he reached out because he saw the pictures I've been putting up of hogs. And he was like, please send us the data on that. And I messaged him. I was like, it's already in Kevin's inbox. Like, so no, trust me. That is. And just as a little aside, we can get a little conservation biology out here before we jump into milk snakes proper. That is a great way to paint a good, you know, to leave a good taste in the mouth of a conservation biologist slash state wildlife biologist, who's the same person who's probably making the herp regs. If the, you know, if the herpers are keepers and they know, well, that's an ethical guy, they're probably not going to make the negative association necessarily with people that are keeping these things at home. So it's a lead by example kind of situation. And if you're really into this, you've got to do that. Like, it's just par for the course.
And I think that a big part, I mean, you know, state by state, there's different collection laws. And, you know, I feel like the West Coast is a lot more liberal when it comes to those laws, which makes sense because there's so much more area for the animals to be. But I feel like you also can offer an interesting perspective as a herper and a keeper when they do regulation changes and things like that. And you can approach your state officials and they already know who you are.
Yeah.
They're not like, who's this guy who's just showing up here and telling us, you know, how to do things. They can say, oh, that's Dave. And, you know, he has a bunch of captive bred milk snakes and likes to go herping and sends us data. Like, that's, you know,
That's a good look.
We'll hear him out. See what he has to say. Exactly. Exactly.
So I have one final question on the herping front. Just sure. realized it. And this is something I was thinking about the other day. So you said that you grew up in the DC area. Did I get yes. that correct? All right. So you grew up in the DC area, obviously did some herping. Then you went out to Tucson, did some herping. Yep. Then you came back to the Mid-Atlantic region, did some herping. So I'm in mm-hmm. you're on the eastern extent of the Mid-Atlantic, and I'm on the western extent of the Mid-Atlantic.
Yes.
I am curious. Herping mm-hmm. in Arizona versus herping in the Mid-Atlantic for snakes specifically. Which is easier?
Arizona is easier 100% because when I and that was a big reason that I kind of left the pet store thing is because I actually thought I was going to go into conservation biology. I ended up going into parks and recreation, which is the field I currently yeah. work in. Definitely the diversity and the ease of finding them in Arizona and the fact that you can just disappear.
Yeah.
And I mean, be gone for days and days and not see a soul. Arizona. I mean, I encourage anyone listening to herp Arizona. If you can, it's an amazing experience. I still try to go like once a year. But I will say that I have found that the Mid-Atlantic and the East Coast has a certain charm to it that if you told me you can never go on another herp trip again and just herp this area, or you can only travel and not herp the Mid-Atlantic, I would prefer to just herp the Mid-Atlantic until the end of my days. Because there's so much less, I feel like so much less known about a lot of the stuff out here, just whether it's agencies focusing more on other things or different things like that. I feel like I've gotten to learn a lot more, especially Virginia. You know, Virginia has like Richmond, Virginia Beach, and then the DC area. And then everything in the middle. I'm not sure if anyone knows what happens there,
yeah.
but I can say like I've gone places and found, you know, corn snakes and king snakes where they're not supposed to be. And like mm-hmm. really gotten to like, you can wander just as much in this area as you can in out west. It's just a little different kind of wandering, you know?
Yeah, no, it's funny that you had that answer, because the first time I went to Arizona, I'd never been there, and I didn't get out there until I was like, Jesus, I think I might've been 40. Like it was a long, way too long. Mid-Atlantic herping is what that's my bread and butter. And unless you've put your feet on the ground and really figured out where you can go, finding snakes is not the easiest thing to do here outside of garter snakes and ringnecks. Like for me in the Wheeling area where I live, if I get one or two black rats in a day, that's like, holy crap, doing backflips down the road. Excitement. So I go to Arizona and I took my like success rate of for the Wheeling area. When I went out to Arizona, I thought, okay, we're going to be lucky if we find like a snake or two. And after the first night of road cruising and we're an hour in and I think we were at like 30, I was like, what the hell is this? And then the herpes we were with were like, oh, this is a bad night. And I was like, no. Bad is not even remote. That cannot be used for this. Like
I spent
experiencing tonight. Like it was insane to me how easy
I spent my Tuesday looking for coastal plains milk snakes. Found two decays, an earth snake, and a dead rat snake. Walked 10 miles or something and got rained on the whole time. And rolled into my house about 2:30 in the morning and. But I'll say this, when I moved to Arizona, before I really knew about like the herping community and like mm-hmm. had like that network, Zach, some nights in Arizona, it may not be one or two black rats, but it's like one or two Aatrox if you play your cards wrong.
Yep.
But I feel like now Arizona has gotten so well known and like the areas are so like that has kind of blown up a little bit and people kind of know when to go, when not to go, where to look, stuff like that. So don't think that you can't go to Arizona and get absolutely wrecked.
No, you can get wrecked, but it was just, and then we were hiking in an, where was that? Chiricahua National Park or
National Monument.
National Monument, yeah. And I took the students that were just going on a hike. Like, I had completely put out of my head that we were going to see snakes. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was hot. Like, everything was not right. And I really just wanted to see, like, the giant granite spiny lizards and all the scallops.
Right, yeah.
And, you know? And so we're just walking down this trail, and one of the students just nonchalantly, there's a rattlesnake. And I turn around, and it's like a 4-foot blacktail rattlesnake sitting right there. And I was like,
holy You cannot beat a blacktail. They're my favorite rattlesnake.
That was the one rattlesnake I wanted to see when we went out there. My
favorite rattlesnake.
But we, like, weren't even looking. And on the way in, we got two coach whips. And then on the way out, we got we saw a dead desert king and a couple goats. Like, it was just – so then, and then we come back here. And it's like, yeah, I got a garter snake last month. So this trip we took to Pennsylvania, the fact we got 40 snakes in 3 days, I was just completely, you know, blown away because PA is mid-Atlantic too.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Well, enough about herping. But I did want to give that context because I really like, you know, I think both Clint and I have a lot of commonality with your background, with the whole being outside and applying it to what we see on the inside. And it's the main reason why I'm spending so much damn time with this book, just going out, trying to find Heterodon, just being in habitat so that when I write about it, I couldn't do that with the first book, certainly doing that with this one because I can't.
Yeah.
So.
And I do find hogs up here pretty regularly. So if you know, and I do really like what you said. I think it was another episode I was listening to about the UV index, and that is so spot on. And you find hognose snakes, it has to be sunny. Like, they love that, like, broken clouds sitting in, like, those warm patches hanging out. And you know, I don't keep eastern hogs. They're protected in Virginia, and there's other people in other parts of the U.S. that do with eastern hogs. I like to see them in the wild, but if I ever was in the position to have them, I feel like you could learn a lot from the ones that you hike and the ones that you see and where they're laying and what they're doing when you, you know, design enclosures for them.
It's funny you said that because when we drove out on Monday and we had, I'm sure the rainstorm came through your area too. But we had a real nasty cold front. And we were basically, we were on like the tail end of the cold front going out to where we were going. And when we parked the car, it was probably like 61, 62, cloudy. And it was not great for snakes. And we hiked where we were going for about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, didn't see anything. And then the sun came out and the temperature went up by about 10 degrees. And I, you know, I had the experience, the herpers with me were like, oh, like you just feel the snake vibe coming. That's what I call it. And then within 40 minutes of the sun coming out, we got two hogs with dirt on their backs. They had obviously come right out in response to the sun. But you know, that's the kind of stuff that I love. And the fun thing is like the operating temperature. We have temp guns. We temp gun every single snake we saw.
Yep, and I mean the same
with the hogs. Every one of them, didn't matter what time of day it was. If they were out, their body temperature was 81 degrees.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, they know what they're doing and they can read that world better than anything. But that's just so invaluable if you're going to try to keep something so specialized. And I'm not necessarily condoning keeping eastern hogs. And we have the temperature, and there's a very narrow window for the temperature. So it's because that's like about as specialized as you can get. But at the same time, it's just really cool to know we have like the UV.
But also, I'll say the fun part of herping, if every snake you temp gun is 81 degrees, now you kind of know what you're looking for. Because that's the other thing about herping that I love is the puzzle of it all.
Yeah.
And looking for a lot of these snakes in places that, you know, places that they are exceptionally hard to find, and figuring out like, oh, bring it all together and then be like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. I didn't even think of that. Mm-hmm. Like, yep. Like looking at the data year after year that I take and going, oh, I bet if I put 10 there, I get one. And then when you do get one, you're like, I'm a genius.
Yeah. It's the best feeling in the world.
I knew it.
Yeah. All right. Well, so with milk snakes,
good stuff.
There's no way we can cover them all. I mean, we're an hour and 15 minutes in. Yeah. I mean, we could. It'd take 8 hours minimum, probably. But I was trying to figure out, like, how do we kind of cover the breadth? Because we have the rare guy that's got them all. So we have North American, Central American, South American forms. And we could have a whole episode just on the historic taxonomy of this group, because there's been recent papers that sunk a bunch of stuff. There's been people that don't agree with that. There's been other papers that have elevated stuff. Like, it's just kind of all over the place. But do you have favorites?
Yes. Like,
what are your top 2 to 3 favorites for North America? What are your top 2-3 favorites for Central America?
Say, yeah,
and your top 2 to 3 favorites for South America?
Perfect. I know that. So my top 3 favorite for North America are Temporalis, the Coastal Plains Milk Snake, obviously.
Yeah.
The red milk snake, Lampropeltis triangulum suspilla. And then I would probably say I could say Louisiana milk snakes, which is they're technically a Western milk snake under Gentilis now. But I'm not working with a lot of those. Those are pretty uncommon in the hobby. I would say the red milks, the coastals, and then probably pale milks. I'm really starting to develop an appreciation for those. I have 3 separate lines right now of those. And I really, really like some of the localities that are out there, as well as, I mean, that whole Western clade, you really see some very like different things depending on where you are. For the South American milks, generally.
Real quick, before you move to them, what localities on the pales are you working with?
I have Platte County, Stillwater County, and then Cherry County. And the Cherry County. The Cherry County animals are the Jeff Hardwick's famous Blazing Saddles animals. Very my Cherry Counties and my Platte Counties are both from Hardwick. And then my Stillwater Counties are from the great and mighty Cole Grover, who is... I appreciate you guys having me on here, but folks like Jeff Colgrover and Aaron Bayer are the reason that most of my collection exists. And they are truly I joke with Cole because someone will ask a question and then Cole will hit them with like a dissertation on their question. And I love it so much because it's like, man, this guy just, he knows his stuff so well.
That is exactly how the first interaction with Cole Grover
went for me. It's how everyone's first interaction with Cole Grover is. It's always like, oh, here's a question. And Cole's like, would you like me to send you a PDF?
That's exactly what he did. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it. Yes, because I will tell you, I really, and this was, again, years and years ago, but I hadn't even heard of pale milk snakes at that point. And I think that, honestly, a lot of us in the hobby probably hadn't, because it's not something you see on a table. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, that kind of thing. And I remember Cole posting some pictures and I reached out and I was like, you know, these are just beautiful. I'm interested in getting some from you. Can you tell me a little bit about them? Because I wasn't familiar. And he replied, absolutely. Here, check this out. And bam, gave me a PDF, you know, with all this information on pale milks and very small species, but man, they are beautiful. They are
incredible,
beautiful.
I have 6 eggs incubating right now from my Cherry Counties, which I'm really excited for. My male has almost no pattern on the head, just like a black outline in between the scales. So I'm really excited to see those pop out. Female is more textbook, but the male is exceptional.
I think it was Bighorn locality what I had. But I think the Cherry are probably what most people see as kind of like the pinnacle,
yes,
you know, as far as localities when it comes from the pales. So Yeah, I had a feeling that, you know, at some point coal was mixed in
with, oh, yeah.
with
oh,
some
yeah.
of those that you had. I had no doubt, but yeah, that's awesome. Okay. Sorry, we can move on to Central.
So Central, so we usually group the North American and South American. I'll say for like the true like central, like the Mexican animals. Mm-hmm. I have a big affinity for Pueblans. I have four different lines of those, all four of them being pure lines. I think that they're one of those things that like, and we can get into it more, but most every milk snake you're going to see on Morph Market is not pure. That's the unfortunate truth and reality of the pet trade. When a lot of these animals came into it, people were just crossing things to get morphs and genetic mutations. I try and focus on my animals having a traceable lineage back to when they were collected, or when the parents or grandparents or great grandparents were collected, and the story that led them from, you know, the Zapotitlan Basin in Mexico to Northern Virginia. So the Pueblan milk snakes I really, really like. And then honestly, Sinaloans and Jalisco milks, the Arcaferra, are my other two Mexican milks that I really, really like. The Sinaloans, I have the Bayer line of Sinaloans, which are Aaron Bayer animal that is like 25 years old. It's ancient. And he crossed it to a Wilson line Kosala animal, which is from Sinaloa's line, which are pure Sinaloans. He has a wild caught Sonora animal. And the result is I've produced them for the last 3 or 4 years now. And you get a snake that's very similar to a Kosala Sinaloan, but it has a black head. And I've gotten the band count down to about 11, and I'm sure I can go lower than that. And then I also have the vanishing pattern stuff, which I really, really like. Those are almost certainly not pure animals. They were likely crossed into Nelsoni, but I just think they're exceptional. They just have little white spots down the sides, and the back is completely red. Then for our South American milk snakes, that's the hard one. The ones that kind of go all the way down. Or I guess I should talk about the Jalisco or the Arcaferra. Those are the high black milks. Those are pretty not common, but you do see them from time to time. A lot of those were crossed into Nelsoni and Ruthveni way back. Mine are the real deal ones that don't have any white on the nose. I've produced them in the past where they are black and white with just little red flames on the side. So I'm really excited this year. I have 2.3 or 3.4 of those. And I'm really hoping that I can get some of those bicolored ones. But then for the South American, the big hitters, I would say the number one is the Ecuadorian or South American milk snake, which is Micropholis. Then the Andean milk snake, which is, I'll say something very controversial, it is the better version of a black milk snake. And then the Yucatan milk snake, which is probably my favorite of that entire, I guess, polyzona group, which is all of the Mexican milks. The Yucatan or Blanchard's milk snakes are incredible.
Which out of that, and maybe, I mean, this would get species specific, but out of those groups that you just gave, which would you say are the easiest to keep?
Mm-hmm. So we'll just knock North America out right now.
Right call. You're right so far.
I'll say it's Andean milk snakes. Andean milk snakes are, they get big, but they are everything a black milk snake wishes it could be.
Go into that. You've got me curious.
You've got to explain this hatred you have.
Because I've got black milks and I love them. They're my favorite.
Don't get me wrong. I love black milk snakes. And I have a pair of the Limon Costa Rica animals. Huh? I will not be getting any more black milk sinks until I can get my hand on a pair of the Miramar locality ones, which they don't turn black. They turn red and black, which is ideal. Look, fellas, I'm into milk sinks because they're pretty, and I do appreciate a black snake. But if I wanted a black snake, I'd get an indigo or open a drawer and look at a Mexican black king or whatever. And there's nothing wrong with black milks. Black milks are incredible snakes. They're still milk snakes, so they're still top tier. But the Andeans, the care, everything is the same, but they just don't turn black. And then the same thing with the South American milk snake, the Micropholis. The Micropholis, the Andeans, you can keep at the same temperature as the black milks. You can keep them like super cool. Mm-hmm. Micropholis, I prefer to keep with heat. Because they are like a much lower elevation animal, but my Micropholis are the biggest snakes in my collection. They, you know, Micropholis can get as big or close to as big as black milks or Andeans, but they're just essentially a lowland variant. So yeah, the Andeans or the South American milks are the pinnacle of that South American group. The Yucatans are great too, but they're a little high strung. And I have found them to be occasionally hesitant in feeding. But, I mean, the South American milks and the Andean milks, the feed responses, I mean, it's Getula-like. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. They come flying out. And they get about the same size. Like, my Andeans and South Americans are, you know, 4.5 to 5.5 feet long. Maybe a little bigger on one of the, I have a male Micropholis that might be close to 6 at this point.
Are the Andeans, are the personalities similar to black milks?
Yep.
Cause I think that's what makes a black milk, my favorite milk snake species that I've kept. I've not kept in Andeans. So I've kept concede Indian. That. But I will say that, yeah. You know, anytime I am on discussing black milk snakes, that's the big thing for me is, yes, I like them, you know, they're heavy bodied, they're bigger, but they aren't nearly as spastic as what a lot of milk snakes are. They're much more laid back. They're much more like, not that other milk snakes aren't handleable. They calm down you know, a little bit, but with a black milk, you really don't even go through that phase. You know what I mean? It's you pick them up and they're okay with it. You know, it's they're just okay with it. So I think that's what I like about them so much.
The Guatemalan milks, the black milks, the Andeans, and the South Americans all kind of have the same attitude, in my opinion. They're very easy to handle. They get big. The Guatemalans are also one of my favorites. They're probably one of the rarest milks that's currently in the pet trade. Mm-hmm. They all get bigger. They're all incredibly laid back. And I mean, from the time they hatch, they're generally pretty relaxed, very easy to handle. Nothing like handling a Honduran or a Pueblan when they're small.
Now, I have a question, and we're going to go down the taxonomy path.
Yep.
Because one of the things for me is for me to keep something, being the nerd that I am, I have to understand the taxonomy.
Yeah.
And this whole South American, Andean, black milk snake, they all had subspecies names.
Correct.
And they were all thrown into Micropholis. And then some of them were recognized. Some of them weren't recognized. Like, and I just kind of got lost in the shuffle. Yep. And I'm certain I could figure it out. But what is the systematics, systematics of just that group? Because I know that Micropholis is a relatively recent name, I think. But does it all of them, based off the lumping idea, or
my understanding is that all the milks that occur in the United States are now per Hillis in his most recent paper, all of those milks are considered Lampropeltis triangulum. Everything that does not occur in the United States, so that would be Anulata, Dixoni, Sinaloan, Honduran, Yucatan, Guatemalan, all those south of the border milks, although Anulata do occur in the United States, I believe, and I might be wrong on the Annulata. That's the one I'd have to go reference my notes from Cole. all of those snakes are Lampropeltis polyzona. So it's kind of been broken out into two separate things. And I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, Annulata is lumped into Triangulum as well. Everything south of the border is polyzona. Now, there is a paper out there that breaks them out kind of into groups, which of similar, like you have polyzona, microfolis, things like that. Personally, regardless of what the most recent taxonomy is, the subspecies names per the Williams book, which if you can get that, I mean, it's on my living room coffee table, and it lives there, and I read,
as it should.
I read it cover to cover multiple times a year. That book and the subspecies that Williams presented in that book, with very few exceptions, break the animals out into a phenotypic, like regional variant that makes the most sense to make determinations and distinguish the phenotypes that you see throughout their range.
Yeah.
You know, Andean milk snakes and South American milk snakes, some people will argue like an Andean milk snake is just like a higher elevation South American milk snake, or the accepted common name for the South Americans, the Ecuadorian milks. But it is helpful with those common names or those old subspecies names to, at least from a herpetoculture perspective, to keep things separated and most closely aligned with that variant, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. Oh, well, I've kind of picked up that herpetoculture is always going to latch on to those subspecies.
Yes.
And we're not letting go.
No, under no circumstances.
And it kind of makes sense. I mean, you know, I'm the crotchety scientist in the room, but I also understand why, because we're here to keep pretty snakes, and we need to add order. And that's a good way to add the order. Let the eggheads like me battle over whether it's a species or not a species or whatever.
I will say, as someone who lives in an area where even the, like the coastal plains milk snake and the eastern milk snake, those animals, as a herper, you can, you know, I have found areas and found milk snakes in places where I go, well, that it's really not a coastal, like it doesn't key out as a coastal, but it's not an eastern. It's that you can see that area of integration. Unfortunately, because Mexico and the areas that a lot of these milk snakes live in is not necessarily the most welcoming to tourists. It's hard for us within the milk snake community to like go see them in the wild and look at different places and go, oh, you know, that looks like this and it's here and that's not where we knew they were, or that looks like an intergrid zone between this and this. So we're kind of operating off of as much old information as we can in looking at the snakes that we have and determining like what they are. For instance, the Pacific American milk snakes, which are the Oligozona, the ones that I have are from Salina Cruz, which I believe those also originated with Cole. Those snakes are kind of in an intergrid zone between Nelson's and I think Nelson's Archifera, the Jalisco milk, and Oligozona. But we have the locality data. We know they're from Salina Cruz. That's the big, like, I guess, thing that at least I focus on is like keeping those localities separate and breeding for the most accurate representation of that locality as I can.
No, fair.
You know, I think part of like Zach, what you said a second ago about, you know, in herpetoculture, we like our subspecies. We like things separated. And it's, and maybe I'm just speaking for myself here, but with as much as the taxonomy has changed, elevated, dropped, you know, on the same group of animals, whether we're talking milk snakes, whether we're talking, I don't know, black rat snakes, or, you know, anything that's, it's, I think it's kind of important for us to try to still keep them separated in the hobby, because while they may get lumped together this year, in 5 years, when they're separated again, now we've got even more quote unquote mutts, because, well, they were all seen as the same thing. So we all just started breeding them together. And then now trying to, you know, pick apart what's pure, what's not pure, when, I mean, that's already difficult enough in the hobby. So I guess for me, I'm always going to be very, very team subspecies, because it's a lot harder to, you know, filter out.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Given the nature of even if you sink the taxonomy, so you get rid of these subspecies and you let South American milks all go into Microphyllus or whatever you want to call it, there's still genetic signal at the geographic level that's causing that feed culture and like all the locality specific stuff. Essentially, all that these localities are, even if phenotype, and there's a term for that, we call it a haplotype, which is basically a locality level population variation. And you can capture that. One of those pesky reports that I have to write about crayfish is literally defining where the different populations live, so that when we breed these things, we aren't mixing the haplotypes together and creating mutts when we go to propagate them. But, like, you know, I look at it, and that's basically all that we're doing is when we have a locale, like, they're not part of this discussion, but they're the best example are bull snakes. So you've got, like, kankakees, which are the you know, they're kind of like shorter, more blackish in color. You've got the tricolor phenotype, but then you can go down to, you know, Texas and get the red bulls. You know, people look at those and have no problem saying those are bull snakes, but you can obviously see those are different bull snakes. Well, you know, there's a environmental factor acting on those genes that's making those animals phenotype what it is. So if we look at the DNA, it's not going to segregate them as two different species of bull snakes per se, but they're almost certainly going to play out geographically. And so when these papers come out and we sync things and do all that, those subspecies still have signal. They just don't have the signal necessary to have a name associated with them based off the criteria of the day. But the problem is the damn criteria changes like by the damn week. So, yeah. And I'm saying this as a guy who has to deal with this. Like, I know herpers are pissed. Imagine being the guy who's got to write the damn paper. Yeah. And the rules are always changing. Like, you know what I mean? No, so,
There's something else I think that, and I'm so we're going on a tangent. Forgive me here.
It's okay. But we do.
So there's something
we'll
else.
Get the husbandry soon. Right.
When we're talking about, you know, taxonomy and we're talking also about trade names, right? And it used to be whenever, and I'm going to give like, I don't know, the Chinese king rats. So when you look in books and if someone is talking about, or I'm sorry, if you're reading an article about them, it's going to list like three or four trade names, right? Stinking goddess and all these other things, right? But when's the last time you actually heard them called anything other
than king rats?
Then exactly. And the reason that we had these multiple trade names in the past with so many other species is because we weren't a global market. We were very regional. It's why you had black rat snakes, chicken snakes. You also had yellow rat snakes that were called chicken snakes. It's all, you know, it was regional. Pilot snakes. You guys remember that they were called that too. Mm-hmm. They're not called that anymore. Unless you have grandpa who still will call them a chicken snake, it's black rat snake. And I, the reason is because there wasn't the global communication there, you know, and I know that especially with like Asian species, you know, that's it. You call it by the Latin name, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, most people it's not king rats, it's carinata, right? That's what you said. Yep. It's not Greenbush Rat Snake. It's Proscenium. Or is it? Because now it's whatever the hell the other thing is that they're just changed it to. And so that's my point is why it's like now in herpetoculture, it is just as important to know the trade name as the Latin name, because the Latin name changes. And isn't Proscenium attached to like three or four different species, you know, out there? So it's like you have to still differentiate what the hell you're talking about, you know, in the first place. And so, you know,
I will say, I think within the milk snake community or cult, whatever you want to call it, because we are working with animals that have been so heavily mixed together. You know, I have with my Hondurans, I have three lines of pure Hondurans from that are like not crossed with anything else. And then I have Kayla, who is on your show. Kayla and I are both working on a project with the Hondurans. We call it the Ash Project or the Ember Project, which is a super high black animal that has very little black in the bands, only red, or I'm sorry, very high black in the bands, very little red, only on the side, kind of like flames. And those snakes, Kayla and I tracked them back as far as we could, but we can't figure out what happened to them from the time that X person had them until we got them. And within the milk snake community, like, as far as I like, that is not a pure Honduran in my eyes. But also, every albino, every annery, every hypo, tangerine, everything else, those aren't pure either. You know, those animals were crossed into Abnorma, Stewardi, Polyzona, everything else to achieve color mutations. I believe the original albino Honduran milk snake was actually an Atlantic Central American milk snake, Lampropeltis polyzona polyzona. And then Atlantic Central American milk snake doesn't sound as sexy. I think that's the way that Aaron Bayer said it to me, as Honduran milk snake. So they just took that albino and bred it into the Honduran. And now we got albino Hondurans. So those subspecies names, I feel like, are important within on the herpetoculture side, because we are trying, there is a group of us that is trying to keep those as pure and as specific as possible, because, you know, during that ball python boom, when colubrids were, I don't want to say throwaway animals, but they weren't what they've become in recent years, we lost almost all of these. If it wasn't for folks like Cole and Jeff Hardwick and Aaron Bayer maintaining them, we wouldn't have a lot of these in a form that is pure any longer.
And it will forever be argued.
Good golly, man. So taxonomy does matter, and sometimes it doesn't. There you go. But for, yes, it will. And for those listening that really, just to ruffle feathers, the superior unicorn snake is not Baranai. It is Jonas. It's Gonosoma honeyensis, the brand new rhino rat snake that everybody loves oh so much. Described from like six species. So there you go. That's for you, Justin Smith. Anyway. Yeah, cool. All right. Back to milk snakes proper, herpetoculture. So how do you keep these things? Yeah.
So,
yeah, do we want to try to pick like a group of subspecies to really hammer in on this part?
In my notes, I have it separated by North American and South American, because I keep them both different.
Okay.
So.
Okay. But if they all kind of lump together, so all North American, you're keeping the same way.
Yeah, they all kind of lump together.
Okay, perfect.
Go ahead.
Well, 1 second. Before we get into that, I don't know, like 20, 30 minutes ago, when we asked you about care before the taxonomy diatribe, you basically alluded to the fact that the North American species might be little nightmares to take care of. Let's just, before we jump into husbandry, what makes them nightmarish, David? There's a reason why I don't keep them. And I was like, okay, North American lamps. I can do the Triangulum group and have pain.
So,
or I can do Getula and not even think, and they'll breed and eat and grow, and everything will be great.
I will say this. They are nightmarish only if you make them nightmarish.
Okay, cool.
I love, so Cispilla, the red milk is like one of my favorites, and I have, like 11 different either localities or morphs of them currently. Those are the Eastern milk subspecies that occurs like in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And as an example, they hatch very small. So they're hatching smaller than a baby corn. They are nervous when they're smaller, but when they're adults, I mean, they can be just like a corn snake, very easy to handle, but they're a little smaller than a corn. I think most of my adults are in the 200-ish, 250-ish gram range. The nightmarish part about them is they're escape artists. Mm-hmm. And they, starting babies after they hatch, can be miserable. But I figured out last year a method that works really, really well that I had pretty much a 100% success rate.
Well, let's just stick with North American since we're going down this
path. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So the way that I get them started on feeding, I'm sure both of you have heard about this before. So I let them hatch. I set them up in like sandwich box containers. Mm-hmm. And I use like drywall tape, that like mesh stuff. And I put it on the, around the holes on the tubs. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as they have their first shed, I assist feed them a frozen thawed mouse tail dipped in a 50-50 mixture of water and beaten eggs.
Okay.
For a little extra protein, a little lubricant. I assist feed them those until they have their second shed. That second shed, they've usually grown just enough that they can take a live day old pinky, and almost all of them do. Very little scenting required. And really it's just getting them from that. Like, and when they do hatch, like some of the bigger ones, I'll offer the pinkies to right off the bat, and they'll take them right off the bat. I've had to use very little scenting with them. If they don't take a live day old pinky, they take a brained and boiled day old pinky. Mm-hmm. It's just getting them to that size where they can take it, or pinky heads. So there's a little more dissection involved with keeping these alive. But once they get started, man, they just eat. I mean, they will eat and eat and eat and grow. And then the care becomes no different than anything else or any other of the, like, you know, core collute, you know,
flubrics. You know, I want to say that when talking about the size, I didn't realize at the time how small the babies really were. And then when I got those first, that first group of pale milks from Cole, it was the very first time I had ever had babies show up in a 2 ounce condiment.
Two ounce
condiment cup. You know what I mean? I was like,
oh my gosh.
And they had room. You know what I mean? It's like, wow. Oh my gosh.
But so, once they get going, they're monsters. Like, they will.
And in fact,
and they're fine.
Even whenever I was breeding the pails. Now, I think maybe the bighorns hatch out a little bigger. And again, thinking back, that's why I started with the bighorn locality, is because babies were a little easier to get going. They hatched out a little bigger. And, so that's why, you know, Cole recommended those. That's what I went with. And sure enough, whenever I bred them, you know, I didn't have to do really too many tricks or anything other than like the boiled or the brain, because they were big enough to take day old pinks, you know, right out of the egg.
And I will say, I don't believe keeping most of these North American milk snakes is any harder than hatching and getting Alterna started. In fact, based on the horror stories I've heard from people that have bred Alterna, these are probably easier. The biggest thing is having a supply or access to those day old pinkies and knowing I guess, the tricks. Like chicken hearts is another trick that I recently learned. I guess not recently, a couple of years ago, from Russ Cormack, who breeds Coastal Plains Milks and Eastern Milks. You just take a chicken heart and you cut it into little slivers, and for whatever reason, they eat it. They eat them. And then you get them to the size that they're big enough to take a pinky, and you just take that chicken heart and rub it all over the pinky, throw it in there. I like to flash boil all my pinkies for the North American milks, just because I feel like it increases that jump from live to frozen. And flash boil them, rub that chicken heart on them, and boom, they take it. So cool. I think that's one of the reasons they haven't been more popular, is because there is a stigma around, like, oh, these are so small and hard to, you know, get started. Most of the snakes that I'm selling, I sell most of them before I list, you know, they have a chance to get to morph market. Mm-hmm. Because while they are not something that is super popular, the group of people that is after them are after them. But when I do list them on Morph Market, I always make sure I am advertising animals that are either eating like regular live pinkies or regular frozen pinkies. And I have sold some of them to people that are just looking for a pet, and they make wonderful pets. It's just getting them from that from the time they hatch until they're consistently feeding.
On that token.
Yep.
How often do you ship them? Like, you've got them going.
Mm-hmm.
Then you ship them. They get to where they're going. And let's just assume the person knows what they're doing and they're listening to you. So yep. we're gonna throw that person who has to handle the living crap out of the snake and dress it out, and it's, you know, mm-hmm. and then it goes off. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about someone follows your directions. How often do you find that just the shipping process kicks them off food, or is it once they get going, they're like many of the Getula Kings or the North American Pantherophis, where you just kind of leave them alone a little bit longer than you normally would, and then that kind of gets them hungry and they start eating?
I have more of an issue with people who buy corn snakes getting them to eat than I do milk snakes that I've started.
Gotcha.
It is truly, even the red milks, you know, I was feeding last night. You open a drawer and you have a mouse, they are like ready to go. Yeah. I mean, it's immediate. So yeah, I mean, it really is that first hump. And then it's the same as a corn or a king or really anything else.
Well, at the end of the day, they are Lampropeltis.
Yep. Yeah. That's true.
Once they start going, they're going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
and so for those listening, and we talk about how small these are, and, you know, because, you know, obviously they're not starting on mouse tails in the wild. So, you know, in the wild, we're looking at what hatchling skinks and
yep.
that type
little
of thing.
Snakes, they're things little. Like that. And I mean, the mouse tail thing, and the issue I've run into is that people try immediately to get them to eat some sort of prey on their own, but they are so small that they very quickly can lose weight. And once they hit a certain like amount of weight lost, you're basically screwed. Like, you really can't bring them back from that. So the mouse tail thing, I mean, it takes God bless my wife. We'll take the sandwich box containers out and sit on the couch and watch TV with the containers on the coffee table and just do the mouse tails for the whole stack of snakes. And it takes, you know, maybe 10 to 15 seconds for each snake. Most of them, once the tail is about halfway down the throat, they just eat it on their own and they're fine.
Yeah.
But I mean, I had a harder time this year getting an Outer Banks king snake that I bought to eat than I had with any of the milks. So
breach
a Knowles.
I put Knowles. If they don't eat at Temporalis Enterprises, they get to go to the basement, which is another method that works really, really well. Is if they're not eating, generally by the time my basement hits a temperature where I can hibernate stuff, I'll put them in the basement for usually about 4 to 6 weeks and then bring them up, and it almost always triggers them to eat.
Yeah, it's certainly, that is a good trick with a lot of different species. But yeah, speaking of the Outer Banks, because Zach sent several Outer Banks my way, yes, and you know, these were several babies that were going to be problems. And, you know, that few weeks they refused for me as well. And then I found that anoles for that particular, you know, that locality, it, bam, anoles really kicked them in.
Guess who has an anole tank?
That makes sense.
Hi, my name is Zach Loafman. Seriously.
It works.
I have an anole tank, and thanks to Gordon, who we had on, I have a Scaloperus tank that's about to be started. Oh, so yeah, no, I'm ready for this year.
I'm hoping.
Yeah, and I mean, the state of Virginia has pretty strict rules on what natives you can keep. You can only have one native species per household that you collected. So, like, realistically, I can't have like a skink tank or something like that. I've thought about trying fire skinks, the African species. They seem morphologically similar.
It's just so you know, because
all right, well, yeah, I thought I was smart.
Me too. And now what I ended up doing was I got a fire skink, and when it passed, we ended up making the, you know, quote unquote, soup, you know, the skink scoop, because I've got a anole soup, I've got gecko soup, I got all these, you know, frozen and ready. But the fire skink, it, I think I got one animal to take on it. However, I am now able, and it's funny, we just started this season. We've all the broadheads and the five line skinks are all out and they're all around the building. And so we now have seven skinks in a little enclosure, and we're hoping to get a little colony of those going. And sure enough, those kicked three snakes in just by rubbing a pinky on them. They really liked it. So, but yeah,
I've used, I think, is it Reptilinx has like a juice. I've had mixed results with it, but I have had success with it. I really do think that in the wild, a lot of these animals will eat rodents if they come across them. And it's just a matter of, I think the biggest thing is the smell of a domestic rodent is off-putting, which is why like the flash boiling and braining, or when I say day old pinky, I mean like it ideally has not gotten a milk meal yet. Like it's red as hot. Fresh as it can be. And it doesn't smell like
red hot.
Yep. Red hot. Ideally, it doesn't smell like really anything, but it's moving around and it's kind of doing its thing, and that will entice them to go, oh, that's food.
Very cool. So we've covered feeding for your North American version of enclosure. So you've already alluded, they hatched out of the egg inside said sandwich box, because our listeners love the nerdy details. Americans, we might have to have you back on for South Americans, but let's talk about like the progression. Is it aspen? Is it pine? Is it a paper towel? Is it barren? Is it complex? Like what's it look like when you're dropping that little neonate in there?
So I generally do a 2 ounce cup for water. I cut a hole in the lid, slap that on there, aspen or sandy chips. And then, something I found it was very helpful to have something for them to like really hide in. Being a herper, a lot of the snakes that I find in the wild are in tin stacks or board stacks. So I've found that taking a paper towel and kind of folding it into like a little stack of its own lets them hide and feel secure. And I use those for the babies. And then the style kind of stays the same as they grow. Like, once I move them into 6-quart tubs, aspen or sandy chip, water bowl, and then I start using those black reptile basics hides. Some subspecies of the North American milks, like the coastals or Louisiana milks, do appreciate a little bit of humidity. But I'll tell you this, in the wild, these snakes do not seek. They seek dry ground 100 times more than they seek wet ground. When it's rainy and I'm going out and finding them, they're as high up in the tin stack as they can get trying to stay dry so they don't get blisters and things like that. So what I do is I will take, I will offer a humid hide if it is necessary, but I'll take a sprayer and just spray a little bit inside the Black Reptile Basics hide so that that area does get a little humid for 24, 48 hours, but then it will dry out. And that generally will alleviate any issue that can be caused by like a snake that's having a bad shed or something like that. You know, I keep my adults in V35 tubs. I use sea serpents mm-hmm. racks, and I keep the temperature right at like 79 to like 80, 81. I don't like to go much warmer than that. And I heat the entire room as well and keep it at about 71 to 73 or so.
Cool.
In the summer, it runs a little warmer. And then in the fall and the spring, it runs a little cooler.
Do you have anything like paper towel rolls or anything else in there?
So I will use egg crate. I really like egg crate. My grandparents and parents, my wife's grandparents and parents bring us every time they come see us paper towel tubes and egg crate, which I will put in there as well. I have found for some of them, if they start acting nervous, like they're cruising around or they're, you know, they're not feeding, mm-hmm. I'll layer stacked egg crate or paper towel tubes in there to clutter it up as much as possible. But I also give my snakes a deeper substrate layer than most people do. I mean, I'm talking like 3 inches, 2.5, 3 inch, like a thick, deep layer of bedding that they can go into so that they can bury and completely yep. cover themselves, make tunnels, mm-hmm. You know, all that. Really, you know, with and there, you know, there's a debate to be had on racks versus cages. My view is milk snakes are fossorial snakes. They live underground. Yes, people find them above ground, but they're above ground for a specific purpose, which is generally moving from one place to another or trying to use the sun or UV to burn off blisters. My snakes get everything they need in their racks and don't have blisters. So they, you know, even in a tub where they have things to climb on and hide boxes and all that, a lot of times under the water bowl, that is the place to be. Like yeah, as tight yeah. and as small as they can get is what they want to do. And that's what I've found in the wild as well.
I think a rack system is good for a lot of these species, because their personality mm-hmm. kind of dictates it as well, where they are a more skittish,
yes.
timid, you know, type of animal. It's better for them to not see us walking past yes. their cages.
I agree.
All day, every mm-hmm. day. I think that it's less stress on them and they actually, it's healthier, you know, at the yeah. end of it. So,
and I have found cool. before, you know, snakes that I've moved up from that 6-quart tub to like a V35, and it's like a light switch. They don't eat. They pace yes. and pace and pace, and then you cram it back into a 6-quart, and it's like all is well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Good golly.
So with these North American, do we want to talk about breeding?
Sure do.
Yeah. Do you cycle? Do you hibernate?
I do.
You know, what's it look like?
So for the North American, what I do is I put them in my basement. Typically they go for, I try and do like Veterans Day to sometime in March. It depends on.
Okay. Like, wait, when's Veterans Day?
Mid-November. Mid-November.
Like, thank you.
Mid-November.
Okay. When is that?
So it's usually, let's see if I have all this written down. It's usually about 75 to 90 days or so that they're in rumination, and it's at, you know, anywhere from it's usually close to 90, and they're between 45 and 55 the entire time, and they're completely blacked out. What I do that a lot of people, especially like some of the older that older generation has advised me to do, I hibernate all of them in groups. So I hibernate them in pairs or groups. I mean, all of my animals, I have several hundred at this point, have like a distinct like ID I use to track them, and those animals will be labeled by that ID code in racks in the basement by the group that they're going to be breeding through. So if it's an albino red milk snake and two posshets that are, I'm going to breed that male to those two, I hibernate them all together, increases fertility. And that even a lot of times as you start to warm them up, that is when some of the breeding occurs. And I have found that to be the case. I have heard anecdotally that it increases where I've had snakes wow. come out of brumation back into the main snake room. And within a month of just coming out of brumation, they're laying eggs.
Cool.
So I will do, Tony Donguera, posted this recently, which I started doing. That's cool. I take the water bowl and I put it in a plastic container with a hole drilled in the top so they can't knock it over during brumation. I found that they're right. That's what I said.
I'm looking that up.
I use the lay boxes with a hole drilled in the top and then put the water bowl in that and sanding chip on the bottom so that if it does spill, it gets absorbed. But they can't knock it over and flood the tub. And what I'll do is generally I bring them up. They go from that like 45 to 55 to, you know, 55 to 65 to 65 to 75. And then I'll bring them back into the main snake room over the course of about 2 weeks.
And so do you see breeding pretty soon after?
Very quickly after.
Okay. And then here's a question. We ask people this a lot. So do you keep your pairs together for like the whole spring, or do you do the male's in there for 2 days, female gets a break for a couple days, or wait for the first shed? Like what's your recipe?
As soon as they come up, I pound them with food, and they are almost like universally as soon as they're warmed up, they slam food. Every 3 to 4 days, they're eating. And then what I'll do is, once they have that first shed or the first low-pressure event happens, I will pair them. I'm a big proponent of I watch the weather.
I do, too. And
whenever that pressure is going to drop off, I pair everything up. And I leave them until the pressure starts to come back up, and then I'll separate and feed them. Generally up here, our weather is such that it is about a 3 to 4 day on cycle and then a couple days off. And then it dips down again with the next thunderstorm or low pressure event. And I have found that is, in my opinion, the cheat code for breeding at least milk snakes. Is when that low pressure system starts to roll in, I'll cool the room down, turn the heater off, cool the room down, and open the windows. And it's like,
that's for a lot of species.
Magic.
The pressure affects so much. I mean, that is up, down, left, right, select, start right there. So
laying eggs, mm-hmm. Zach in one of the shows said like, it's crazy when the pressure drops off. I think you said it's either the laying of the eggs or the hatching.
Both.
And I started watching that, and he is a scientist for a reason. It worked.
Thank you.
It's almost like clockwork. Like I'm looking at this girl and I'm like, give me your eggs. And then a thunderstorm rolls in. I'm home after work. There they are. Mm-hmm. And I wonder why that is. I mean, I'm sure there's a variety of reasons it could be. But it does seem to be very much like a trigger for that.
Yeah, no, it's got to be with their ability to chemosense and the air currents. And another thing I thought about, which is dumb, but at the same time, I'm like, is that dumb? Is that maybe when they're coming together and they're breeding, if you think about like these, what we call meta predators, which are things like raccoons and bobcats and possum, like the thing that's going to eat a snake, if you're coming together to breed, you're going to let off a lot more snake stank. So those things are going to be able to smell you. But if you're breeding in a particular area and then the rains come in, it's going to mask you it might, you know, mean that the predators aren't out as often. And then I sit and think about that and I'm like, hey, you're full of crap, Loafman. That's not a thing. And then I say, you know, so I don't know, but that might be like a little,
I think based on my
lots of
things based on my wild observations of these species, right before a low pressure event or right after, as it's falling or rising, there, if you know what you're looking for, finding them is like clockwork.
Yeah.
It's the stagnation that makes you go out and hike for 10 miles and you're like, Jesus Christ, I never want to see another snake.
That's why we had such a good week in PA that we had, the weather was perfect because we came in after 3 days of turbulence with pressure and storms and everything else. And it was cold and then it warmed up. So we got them on the, oh, got to get warm now. So they came out and moved. And then we had like a day and a half of that. But then when we quit on Tuesday, I think it was, you know, we were in this high pressure system. It was hot. It was warm. It was sunny. And then it rained overnight. And yesterday morning, we had our first snake 30. No. Well, let me see. The students left before I did. And of course, they found the freaking pit viper. Like, that's the great thing being a teacher is, you know. It's one thing when you're out with your buddies and someone does something stupid. It's another thing when the 19-year-old does something stupid and we have to talk to the hyper-reactive and very emotive college administrators that are like, so why were they messing with the venomous one? So anywho, but no, we had a copperhead within 5 minutes of leaving the van. Wow. And I thought like, because we didn't see any copperheads, but the rain. Yeah. And then boom, another copperhead. And then a hog, and then a hog, and then a rat snake. Like, we had a great morning. It was just because
yeah.
pressure and the rain and everything. Like,
yeah. And no. I think that again, combining that, like those things you learn when you're herping and using that in a captive setting, like I've had species before that, like Yucatan milk snakes are another example, which are one of the South American varieties. Like, they're super hesitant to go before we actually get like a real thunderstorm up here. But in the last like week or so, we've had like not like full blown thunderstorms, but like that it's real hot and then it cools off super fast and you get that rain. And that's the trigger. And now those are locking up. So, you know, I think that has a huge role to play in anyone keeping and breeding snakes is. Just because they're inside doesn't mean they know what's going on outside.
Well, if you really want to get it going, I have mine in a garage, and I have gone down and opened the garage door. You know,
yeah. The room I have mine in has four big. It has four big windows, and I'll just open. Yeah. I'll open the windows up and turn the heat off and let them naturally cycle through that. And it, I mean, it's. It's like crack. Like they just go.
So
one second before we move to incubation, I just have to say, so, you know, I was on another podcast and Zach commented while I was on there off something I said. I said that colubrids were the Barbie doll of the snake world because you can dress them up however you want because they come in so much thing. And he said that that's going to be one of our t-shirts, one of the, you know, CCR t-shirts or colubrids or the Barbie doll. Well, I can tell you now that the second t-shirt design has just come from Zach Lohman's mouth, whether he realizes it or not. And that is, we're about to talk snake stank. So I mean, that right there, that's the quote right there.
There you go.
All right, let's move to incubation.
Yes.
we've got eggs.
So
we've got eggs. Now what?
You got eggs.
Easy perlite pack, sphagnum moss on top to keep mold down, and then I do a very small hole in the front and the back of the tub and I throw it on top of the racks.
Nice.
And when they hatch, and I haven't had a single kinked snake in 4 years.
So I want to say that what you just described in your tub, like, I don't do the moss and I do use incubators for a lot of the species I use, but I follow the exact same thing. One small hole in the front, one small hole in the back. And personally, I feel that gives the exact amount of airflow that is needed to keep the humidity right, but not to basically suffocate the egg. So I'm so glad you said that, because it's like, yes, do it the exact same way.
I did vermiculite for a long time, but I found that the vermiculite that I was able to find was so fine that it would get stuck to the, with the umbilical opening. And I never had any issues with it, but I just didn't. And we get stuck on the snakes and stuff like that. I learned that from like using vermiculite from my time at Outback. And I mean, that was mostly ball pythons and I always used it. But then when I went to the milks that are so much smaller, I switched up to perlite and then packing that moss on top. If one egg molds, I guess the moss is, I think it's acidic.
Yeah.
It's slightly acidic enough to keep the mold down. And so I just pack the moss on top. And then, yeah, I mean, tiny hole. I don't even have a soldering iron, like tip small enough. I use a lighter and this weird metal thing. I don't even know where it came from. It's obviously something that came in one of those like snake. It's not a probe. It's like a probe, but the end is just ever so slightly bent. I just heat it up and it's just small enough to poke a hole about three times as big as like a thumbtack hole on each end. And then I just throw them on top of my hatchling racks and let them incubate. And usually incubation time between 45 days and like 70.
God damn. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be fluctuation.
Keep going.
Yeah. It fluctuates between, you know, 71 and 77. But never in big spikes. It's generally like they start incubation a little cooler, and then by the time they're hatching, it's a little warmer. I say cook them low and slow because you want them to hatch as big as possible. So I prefer a clutch that goes, you know, 80 days, 90 days than a clutch that takes, you know, 45 or you know, 60.
I do want to say that I prefer the perlite over vermiculite. And I used to be, you know, very hardcore vermiculite for years and years, but I think really it's for two reasons. One, because it's a lot cleaner. I mean, you have the initial dust but with vermiculite, it's almost like I got glitter all over. It's like I'm coming home from the club, you know? It's
exactly.
So I don't like that. But something else I found that I can do with perlite is I can get almost a good layer of kind of just soup at the bottom of that perlite.
Yep.
But the top still remains dry. You know, because it's like it drains down through the perlite and into the bottom. So with your eggs, they're resting on that drier part, but you get all the humidity that you're after because of how much water you've got underneath, you know, and in that soupy area of the perlite. So, yeah, I think that's, in my opinion, the better of the two media there to incubate on. So with you there, too. Fantastic.
Cool. And you just covered... We did it backwards, but that's fine.
How to take care of the babies.
We covered starting the babies and going from there.
Good. Yep.
So.
And I mean, really the only difference with the South Americans is bigger enclosures. And I use cypress mulch for the adults, not aspen. For the babies, I will use aspen or sandy chips. For the adults, I like to use a deeper tub, the V28 tubs, or my preferred large tub, which I've been buying up here locally as I see the racks pop up for sale, is when I worked at Outback, there's an old tub called a CF750. And it is the perfect snake tub. And no one makes one that's anywhere near the size that it is. It's like 3 foot by 14 inches by 14 inches.
Wow.
And it's... you can pack in like a 5 or 6 inch deep layer of mulch, and you know, you can put a bigger milk snake in there, and I'll use again a Reptile Basics hide box. And I don't like the 41 quart CB, whatever they are, 70s, because they're so shallow. I feel like when you have a bigger snake, you want something a little taller. And so I use those as I'm able to buy them up. I have a stockpile of ones I've bought in my garage. And I use those for the bigger, like Hondurans, South Americans, Guatemalans, things like that. The smaller ones like Pueblans and Nelsons, the V28s are about perfect, which I think are a little more than 32 quarts. I do like to give them the cypress mulch because it goes in wet and then it dries out and I can mist it down. And I actually will mist the bedding down except for under the hide. And I give them that hide option as like a dry hide that they can use to get away from the moisture. But if they want to dig down, they can get into more humidity, and the depth of the bedding that I put in there kind of provides like a humidity gradient. The higher up they come, generally the lower it is. As the water kind of settles down to the bottom, it's warmer and more humid. But I do, like I said, I do give them a really deep layer, but I don't keep them any warmer than the North Americans. Hibernation wise, they're only getting 60 to 75 days at 58 to 60 degrees, but they get a like a full light cycle type of that was the advice Cole gave me. And that's worked out really well, where yep. I just pull all the lights in the room and just let them naturally cycle with the light and a little, you know, a little warmer temperature. And then I slowly warm them back up. This year I only did 60 days. I think next year I'm going to go a little longer, sweet. But it seemed to have worked out really well.
Let's do final question.
Let's do it.
Cause you just gave a freaking treatise on milk snakes. That was wonderful. And I think that our show needed milks covered that way. Mm-hmm. Now Kaylee did a great job with Hondurans, but that was Hondurans. This was pretty badass.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed this one, David. So the question that we always ask is like, where do you see herpetoculture going? And I'm really curious on your perspective, given the herping background, the hyper focus on, you know, one big group doing it well, but letting the, you know, the herping drive the husbandry in a manner of speaking. But
you've been exposed to importation. You seem to be very well rounded on it. So
what are your thoughts?
So I much like Clint, have come from a background where I've watched this industry change and seen what's in, what's out. I keep a very close eye on all of that. The industry, I think, is trending toward diversity. It is trending away from a monoculture that is a pretty snake in a plastic box, and trending towards people once again truly keeping stuff that they just think is badass. And I think that the industry also, especially as a result of COVID, is no longer a breeder to breeder business anymore. I remember during my pet store days, I did a lot of online sales then, and it was always like everything I sold. It was never like, I just want a pet. It was, oh, I'm going to breed these. Oh, I'm going to do this. A lot of my sales on Morph Market are to people that just want a pet. And I think that is very healthy for this industry. And I think that as long as people do what makes them happy and that they can talk about with enthusiasm and charisma, that's what people should do. You know, it's none of us are in this for the money. We're all in it for the animals and because we enjoy doing it. And I think that ball pythons will always have a place and they will always be around. Same thing with crested geckos, leopard geckos, bearded dragons. But I think you are going to start seeing people really turn towards what else is out there. And I have noticed, you know, with the milk snakes, like most of the species I listed tonight, I'm operating on a wait list for. Like people want them because I remember seeing Andean milks 10 years ago, 15 years ago at reptile shows. And then when I started getting into the milk skin, I was like, what the hell happened to Andean milks? And now it's like they're nowhere to be found. You know, like they're just not there anymore. And I think that there is going to be this resurgence of people not collecting whatever bumblebee, clown, spot nose, this or that that's out there for one species. But you're going to have people that are like, wow, I really liked that California king snake I bought from Zach. I wonder what other king snakes are out there. Or like, you know, Clint with his, you know, false water cobras or whatever. Like they see one and then they want to, after that, both of you have them. They see one and then the next, then they're like, well, what's next? What's after the false water? Not, I just want a bunch of false water cobras. Cause I know I'm seeing myself trend that way. Like now I'm starting to get into king snakes. I've started to get back into the Asian rat snakes. I mean, my wife has blue tongue skinks and egg eating snakes and beaked snakes and Pac-Man frogs and Lichianus geckos and tarantulas. Like that is, I think, the direction we're going. And I think that a lot of people in the future of this industry is reptile expos and online marketplaces are going to look a lot more like a zoo than just an endless sea of the same thing painted differently.
Mm-hmm. I hope that is true, but I agree with everything
you said. Oh, it'll still be there. It will still be there.
Mm-hmm. Well, but one, I have like actually something to feed off of that. So I went to the local show and I go to the local show to get my feeders. I won't say what the local show is. I have a tendency apparently to dig on it a little bit. The
paparazzi might find you.
Yeah, well, they kind of have. So anyway, which is why we're not going to name names. But the show normally drives me crazy, and I've been going to it since 2014, and I didn't realize it's been 10 freaking years. That kind of – it feels like it's been like three, but anywho. And I went this past Sunday with my son, and it's our tradition. I can't tell if he wants to go to the reptile show more or it's the Waffle House after the reptile show that he wants to do. And I'm leaning more towards Waffle House because it's like super early in the morning and he's barely cognizant of anything when we walk through the door. So I went in to get my rodents because that's the only way I can get them quick. And I usually do like a quick pass. And this was the first time that I noticed, like, we always talk about how important, or not how important, but like hognose. We don't have a lot of hognose here in the Wheeling, Pittsburgh area. I saw hognoses on table. I saw tricolor milks on tables. Mm-hmm. I saw Asian rats on tables. I saw different subspecies of Getula kings on tables. And it used to be the classic ball pythons, crested geckos. I saw those, but it was just kind of interesting to note that, like, huh, there's, you know, this is a monthly show, so it's got a dedicated set of vendors. And in the past 10 years, I have definitely seen it start to trend towards diversity. Mm-hmm. And the monoculture is still there, but it's just not as dominant as it used to be. And Colin and I, my son, we were talking about it. And I said to Colin, like, I'm okay with that. I'm not anti-ball python. I like looking at the ball pythons. I think some of them are cool. I just don't want every freaking snake to be a ball python. That's, you know, so it just was nice to see that.
Me either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I tell people all the time that shit on ball pythons. I say,
that's
if it weren't for ball pythons, you would not have the infrastructure of king snake and rodent pro, or not king snake. Whew, Jesus Christ. The infrastructure of Morph Market and Rodent Pro and ARS and Vision and all these things. Sea Serpents. I mean, I buy all my racks from Sea Serpents. I got a lot of racks from Sea Serpents, but they don't exist because of the guy that breeds milk snakes. Mm-hmm. They exist because of the ball python industry. And because of how big that is, the savings that I get are passed down because he's producing such volume. So ball pythons are necessary for the continuation of this hobby. However, there is a place for them to step out of the limelight a little bit and let the other things kind of start to develop their following as well.
And I don't even think it comes down to them, you know, like really It's not even that the ball pythons have to move, because they will be moved is what's going to happen.
Yes.
This comes back to, and I know I'm the market guy, it comes back to the market. It's where the market is starting to dictate that it wants more of this, you know, this diversity, right. It wants more of this spread. And when the market keeps doing that, then individuals are going to supply it. You know, that's just the way it works. And so we will continue to see more and more of a shift of more and more diversity. And you are spot on. People have asked me, what's the next big species? What's the next, you know, big thing? And I don't see a next.
There's
been so very few big things.
Yeah.
You know, when you really think about it, the corn snake, the ball python, we can even say leopard geckos, crested geckos, that kind of thing. But that's about it. You're going to name the species that were big things, right? Instead, it's going to be diversity. It's going to be people want to see different things. They want to, you know, get their hands on different things. And so if that's what people want, eventually that's what's going to happen. It's just like people wanted all these ball python morphs. And, you know, that's why the shows became ball python shows, was because that's what was in demand. And as the demand shifts to everything, like you just said, we will see, to your point, Zach, a change in what's happening at the shows.
Yeah.
Yep.
100%.
Well, this was excellent.
Absolutely.
I really had fun. Great, great show, David.
Thank you.
Awesome. We'll definitely have you back on again, because there's so much nuance to this group of snakes. And so one thing we didn't cover, just out of curiosity, what would you say your collection is at right now as far as numbers? Or is this like you don't count so you don't know kind of thing?
It's more of I don't count so I don't know. I'm currently expecting about 46 clutches this year or so. Nice. You know, I have some palmetto corn snakes that I'll produce. I have some locality Mexican black kings that I'll produce this year, some Japanese forest rats. Then everything else is assorted milk snakes of all shapes and sizes. Probably the biggest group of them being red milks, like individual species, but that gets overshadowed so quickly by the, I think it's 18 or 19 specific subspecies breeding this year.
Good golly. Well, so if people are interesting, you said you had wait lists for a lot of these, but I'm sure there's some that are
available. Of course.
How do people find you?
So I'm on Instagram and Facebook under Temporalis Enterprises, as well as Morph Market. Trying to get my Morph Market completely updated with pictures for each like animal in my collection, so people can go in and see what the different localities and things look like. I'm trying to kind of figure out how to build out something where they can see the parents and then all the different variations of babies that have come from that. Generally, when you're breeding locale to locale, you get kind of the same phenotype, but within those localities, there's definitely like extremes on each end.
That's fair. Okay. Well, thank you. Yep. Any final thoughts, or are we good to close out now?
No, I really enjoyed this. I definitely think down the road, the South Americans might need a little more love. But you know, it was great to get on and talk and hopefully people find it interesting.
Well, I'm sure they will. This is going to be one that is well appreciated. Trust me. I'm going to be listening to this one multiple times. because I jumped into Lampropeltis and I went the easy route, I feel, with the Getula. Though those OBX Kings and some of those Florida babies did humble me a bit. I am all about redemption, though, so those lizards better get ready.
Yeah.
But anywho, okay. Well, that's where you can find David. Before we close out, try to do this as often as we can. Want to thank NPR Network. Obviously, want to thank the Podfather himself, Eric Burke, he will inevitably do the final podcast stuff articulate.
The editing, the posting, the, all that. Yes.
So
there you go.
And we thank him.
See, Zach can use big, fancy PhD yes. words, but things like editing elude him.
I don't know that one. That you know, thank you, Eric. Thank you. And we're proud to be members of that network and listen to the other shows. Those of you who want to get a hold of me, Zach Loafman on Facebook, Dr. Crawdad on Instagram, and then email me at zloafman@westliberty.edu. Go to sign up for the International Herpetological Symposium, please. We put that day together. There are definitely some people that are coming resultant of our podcast. We did on that. But, you know, if you're in the Knoxville area, it is worth a day of your life to come listen to those talks. Plus, you get a behind the scenes badass tour of the Knoxville Zoo's reptile department. And the curator of the Knoxville Zoo is a listener to our show. So there you go. And then, Clint, where can people find you?
You can find me on Facebook under Clint Bartley or Metazotics there on Facebook, Metazotics LLC on Instagram. Please check out our website, metazotics.com, for all of the available animals. And as a reminder, if you are looking to purchase anything from Metazotics, if you use the coupon code CCRadio online there, you will save 5% off of anything that you purchase.
All righty. So whatever time of day, night, morning, afternoon it is, hope the rest of it is great. And with that, have a good one.